Hello, right-minded listeners. Did you know that She Writes Press and Spark Press host a publishing contest every year as part of our commitment to elevate and publish more writers of color? Well, this year's contest is now open, and we're accepting applications through July 5th. And at the end of it all, we'll be onboarding two new authors, one to She Writes Press and one to Spark Press. So we hope that you'll spread the word, tell a friend, post on social media, and apply yourself if you meet the criteria. You can find out more at shewritespress.com/equality-in-publishing, or make it easier on yourself by Googling She Writes Press STEP Contest. STEP stands for She Writes Press Towards Equality in Publishing. Thanks so much.
Hello, rough drafters, revisers, and writing revelers. I'm Grant Faulkner, writer, struggling writer, aspiring writer, and executive director of NaNoWriMo. And I'm here with the knowledgeable scribe and publisher, Brooke Warner. And Brooke, I read a quote this week that intrigued me. The writer said, "What makes us writers is as much what we throw out as what we keep." And I was interested in this because as writers, we focus so much on getting the words down on the page, on reaching word count goals and page count goals. And yet I've heard many writers say that as much as 90% of the rough drafts don't make it into their final drafts because, as this quote says, writing is as much about throwing out as it is about writing. And the writer behind that quote actually decided to abandon a 90,000 word novel while on a writing retreat. And similarly, our guest today, Nicole Glover, recently abandoned the first 30,000 words of a novel she started last November and then restarted. And I'm so intrigued by this because it's so not me. You know, I'm a natural born hoarder and I cling to the words I've written. So I'm curious about the creative act of abandonment. Have you ever abandoned a large chunk of writing like Nicole and started over, Brooke? Or how do you deal with cutting text you've spent hours and hours writing?
Yeah, I have to confess that I just have not thrown out that many words or even close to that many words. I wonder if that's a function of being a nonfiction writer as well. You know, I sometimes think that might lend itself a little bit more to novelists. But that said, I have a couple of examples of memoirists who have thrown away that much work or more. Notably, my memoir heroine, Mary Carr, has shared this story a lot about writing Lit, her third memoir, three times. You know, the first version was where her ex did everything wrong and he was to blame for everything that happened in their relationship. And in the second one, she did everything wrong and she was to blame for everything that happened in their relationship. And then she finally settled on the draft where both parties were to blame, you know, which is usually how it goes when relationships fall apart. So it just took her that long to get to the more honest draft. And then Linda Joy Myers, who I teach with, she threw away her entire manuscript. It was like 60 to 70,000 words because, as she says, she wasn't capturing the right voice. And then when she came back to it after some time, she just wrote it pretty fast. I mean, I think when she came back to it, it's like it was already written in her head and it took her a few, well, not just a few months, but maybe like 7 or 8 months instead of the previous 3 to 4 years she had been spending on the other draft. So I think it's an example of like a deep inner trust that a person can have, like a deep inner knowing sometimes. But like you said, you know, having the willingness to let go is a big deal because of all of the hours you spend crafting those sentences. And I guess in the case of Mary and Linda, what I would say is like, there's a time spent on the foundation, and so it's not really totally wasted.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I certainly view my unpublished novels in that light as learning experiences that I build on, not as big wastes of time. Still, after all of these years writing, I still have problems cutting large chunks of writing, and I've never truly started over from scratch. You know, like I'm a person who is inclined to save things by impulse, whether it's a broken chair I think I can fix or words that I've written. I think I just really want to try to fix them instead of throwing them away. But that said, I am a big fan of editing energetically and killing your darlings, as the saying goes. But I tend to save all my cuts in a separate file, which begs the question, why? Or that's what I'm asking myself now. If I've cut something, you know, why keep it around? And I think this is a good question because I've dug into those files, which are always appropriately labeled dump. And I've actually unearthed writing and reintroduced it into the the novel or the story, you know, because the writing itself isn't necessarily bad. Like it was cut because it wasn't really serving the story as it should have. But I found that 9 times out of 10, you know, reintroducing the text has been a bad practice. I think there's something about cutting something that should be permanent. So I'm now very hesitant to open those dump files, although I still keep them. I keep them like I keep broken chairs that I think I can fix that are sitting outside in my yard. So those broken chairs are an apt metaphor, actually. But restarting a novel entirely from scratch is a different question. I'm so interested in that story about Linda Joy Myers. So I guess it's, you know, maybe this is common, although they started over with their same book, I guess, not with a new book. Have you ever heard of someone kind of restarting from the fire, so to speak, Brooke?
Yeah, I mean, that does happen too. I do have to think that it's less common, or maybe just hear about it less often. But when I was researching stories for my most recent book, Write On Sisters, I came across one about Margaret Atwood, and that she had this book that she was working on prior to The Handmaid's Tale that she just abandoned. You know, I get the impression that it was farther along, but she talked about it being the foundation, or like it wouldn't, The Handmaid's Tale wouldn't have happened if she hadn't written that book. So I think it's like a slight variation on the thing because it wasn't working, right? And she's just like, I can't keep pushing on this. And then it opened the door for this other book, which of course became one of the best selling books of all times. So I think there's like this starting over, redoing, doing it differently, you know, lots of different iterations of what we're talking about today. And, you know, it's striking me as like a little bit complicated because I think writers might feel like, well, how do I know, you know, how do I know to trust myself or not? That's a hard question.
I don't know how to answer that question. But I do think like it's amazing to think how many books walk that fine line of frustration and nearly never came out. You know, when you're talking about The Handmaid's Tale, it reminded me of Stephen King's Carrie, which he started writing before anyone knew who Stephen King was. And in fact, I think he was the definition of a poor, struggling writer at the time. And he started Carrie, then threw away all of the pages he wrote. And it was only because his wife fished the pages out of the trash can and put them back in front of him because she thought it was a really good story that he continued to write it. And then, you know, sold 1 million copies in its first year and went on to become a popular film with Sissy Spacek and launched his career. And this also made me think of Marlon James, who I talked to a while back. And I guess I'm fascinated with his story because he had a novel rejected 78 times and he destroyed all copies of it that he had. I think even the digital copies, because he had to comb through a friend's email to find an old digital file of it. But if he hadn't done that, we might not know, you know, the name Marlon James today. So thank God for digital files. But it's definitely, I think, still really difficult for a writer to discern the difference between what is just a tough writing period versus, you know, writing the wrong thing. So how would you answer this question, Brooke?
Yeah, that's it. That was the word I was looking for earlier, discernment, which I think is better than trust, mm-hmm. you know, because it's the discernment is the thing that writers are not always the best judges of, right? Like writers can sometimes think they have done a really crappy job and then I'll read something they've written and I think it's really good. You know, so this thing that you've identified with Carrie seems important to me because, you know, fundamentally, with Mary Carr and Linda Joy Myers and Margaret Atwood, they were all saying like the story is flawed and it needs to be abandoned or redone. But the Stephen King story is different because that actually reminds me of a similar story with Harper Lee. You know, there was a moment of desperation where she threw To Kill a Mockingbird out the window, apparently, and it landed in the snow and her agent rescued it. Thank God. I mean, who knows? That could be an exaggerated tale. But, you know, we certainly have heard of these writers who have fits of passion or fits of frustration. And if you're not a good judge of your own writing, then you might be throwing away a masterpiece, right? Or starting over something that's actually perfectly salvageable. So this is just comes back to discernment, right? On the one hand, I think you have to not be afraid to start over, and that actually is really good advice. And on the other, you have to be a good enough judge of your own character, right? Like are you discerning? Are you, or, you know, on the other hand, are you impulsive? Are you prone to passionate fits in your creative process, right? Are you overly harsh on yourself? Because so many writers are. And so I guess the only thing, like to your point, thank God for digital files, because we're not really like throwing our loose pages into the trash or into the snow anymore, you know, and one can keep them on their computer and come back after the fit of passion is over and be like, oh, thank God it's still there.
Yeah, exactly. That's such an interesting story about Harper Lee. I didn't know that. And it just makes me think that it's good to remember that writing a novel has its periods of intense frustration. So it's best to listen to your story's calling with a more measured mind, I suppose. You know, it's such a personal decision whether to write a novel or book and keep writing it. And it's so much a part of your overall spirit and vision. You know, I've heard writers say that after abandoning a book, for instance, they don't feel grief, they feel liberation, which is definitely a good sign that you should maybe move on. But I think it's worth checking in if you abandon a book to, you know, check in with yourself and see how you feel a week or a month later, see if you still feel liberation or see if you're still maybe hearing its calling again. And I think that that's your point of discernment as to how that book is calling you and what urgency you feel.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as with all things, all advice on writing, it's like cultivating whatever it is, discernment, trust, both internally and externally. And I can't wait to hear more about the moment that Nicole started over and hear what she has to say about her new novel, The Conductors. And we will do that after this very short break.
Welcome back, everybody. I am thrilled to introduce Nicole Glover, who works as a UX researcher in Virginia. She believes libraries are magical places and problems seem smaller with a cup of tea in hand. I want to live the rest of my life according to that belief. Her life outside of books includes bicycles, video games, and baking the perfect banana bread. The Conductors is her debut novel, but she's got more novels in the works. So welcome, Nicole. Can't wait to hear about them.
Hi, thanks for inviting me on.
Absolutely. Well, hey, Nicole, I want to start by learning a bit about your writing journey. I know you've participated in NaNoWriMo in the past, and I know you hold down a day job in addition to writing, as many writers do. But I want to hear a little bit more about how you decided you became a writer and that, you know, journey that happened after that decision, and then how you managed to be a writer in a busy life.
I've always wanted to be a writer. From a long time as a kid, I had been a big reader, and I always saw these books out in the library and stuff like that. And I thought, you know, it'd be kind of cool to be a writer. I always like, especially the idea that you can be an author, to have that sort of life. So I decided from a young age I was going to be a writer, and everything else I've done is kind of support that kind of writing life. I went out to school and picked up certain jobs and like that. Everything was basically allowed me to have the free time to write. And as a UX researcher, a lot of the stuff that I do is it runs parallel to the writing, but it gives me a lot of certain skills like researching, like checking certain things or tests and all the psychology aspects of it always kind of tie close into all my writing stuff. And sometimes it's tricky kind of balancing all that out because I spend a lot of time writing at night. Basically, I'm a night writer, staying up late and spending that time as well on the weekends, writing and stuff. On like kind of a strict schedule in a certain sense. I think sometimes during the day job I'll take a break during lunch. I might jot down some ideas, especially when I used to be back in the office. I would spend my lunch break going for a walk, and I'll go to the library and sit down there, brainstorm some ideas, outline certain scenes of the night, and have those kind of in my back pocket to be ready to go when I write at night. But a lot of it's kind of getting on a strict schedule of like sticking to that time period that I have basically a time to write. And in the same way also too, trying to keep making sure I have blocks of time where I can rest and relax because I am working all the time and it's not that good for either job to working all the time.
Yeah. I relate to that for sure. And most writers do. And I love how disciplined you are. Thanks for sharing some of those ideas that you have. And I wanted to ask about the subject of this novel because of the way it combines magic and history and also commentary on your own present moment. So I just wanted to read a little part of the description so that listeners know what the book is about that reads, as a conductor on the Underground Railroad, Hetty Rhodes helped usher dozens of people north with her wits and magical powers. Now that the Civil War is over, Hetty and her husband Benji have settled in Philadelphia, solving murders and mysteries that white authorities won't touch. And so, as you written this murder mystery, basically, and this protagonist, I'd just love to hear, you know, why you decided to write this novel and why you merged history with fantasy and even magic.
Yeah, this novel actually has different ideas. It started out as a purely historical fiction short story that wasn't really going anywhere. I had the idea for the character and that basic idea of like the setting of the historical time period. But it wasn't really going there for a few years until I decided one day I'm going to add magic to it. And it just started coming together from there. I started to feel like filling out the world, filling out what the character's going to do, what kind of journey he's going to go through. And the mystery element, oddly enough, kind of just fell into place after I added that magic aspect to it. I guess because I had the idea of, like, I've always been interested in, like, what people did after certain things. Like, I always had the story about these underground railroad conductors. And I was always kept wondering, like, what do they do after the Civil War's over? What do they do when their job is technically done? And, you know, I mean, like, the real-life answer is, like, you know, they got into, like, community activism and education and stuff like that. But I had the idea, you know, they solved murder mysteries. Because, you know, I see them as having these certain skill sets that would be really useful to solving mysteries. And I always loved a good murder mystery. And, I don't know, it was just basically kind of fun mixing up the history and magic. Because those are all those three different genres of mysteries, histories, and fantasy were all genres I always loved to read about. And so it was kind of fun to me to kind of merge them all together and just, you know, kind of write a story that's of characters that reflect me, that reflects my interest, and that was in the time period I was really interested in exploring.
That's so interesting, Nicole, just how you were writing a historical fiction to begin with and then added magic kind of later, and that opened the doors to other things. And I think, you know, writers always playing with reality a little bit, whether you're writing fantasy or even realistic literary fiction. And so I'm curious about this historicism that you started with and how you balanced, you know, adhering to historical facts and then shaping an independent story world, especially one that has magic in it. And also, I'm just curious, did you base any, you know, of your characters on real life characters?
A lot of my characters, I took inspiration from the people who lived in the time period, a lot of people who lived in Philadelphia or in and around that area, that time period. I took inspiration. It's just what some aspects of it, whether it's like, you know, whether it's like certain jobs they did or interests they had, because different education to artists, to scientists, that sort of thing, and kind of input those research into there. I think a lot of the secondary characters I took inspiration, like especially when I looked, I did some research about Civil War, about different soldiers, about other people who worked in the camps and whatnot. I just took inspiration from all those different things, kind of added that into the secondary characters. And you know, for the main character, I took some inspiration, just more like just things that interested me. I wanted to have reflect in the characters to give them like a well-rounded view of the historical aspects of it.
I wanted to ask you about the real world for a second, sort of segue into the fact that, you know, it's just been such a force to reckon with for every writer lately, to put it mildly, across a lot of different fronts. And I was intrigued, you know, I read something you wrote about how the outside world is affecting you, and you said, "I think a large part of my jitters revolving around my books is just worries about the state of the world funneled into the one place where I have some control over matters." And so I was just hoping you might comment on the relentlessness of what we've been going through over this past few years and how you've handled that, you know, just especially in terms of your stories and your writerly imagination.
I guess for me, writing is like one area I still have complete control over, because I can decide, you know, what happens in the story, basically, from literally like what the characters do to how the plot goes. It's an area that I can control, like I can make change to it. I can choose not to change certain things to it. So it's an easy way to put all my worries into it, and kind of go from there. And I don't know. I guess also I always found writing kind of therapeutic in the way. As a kid, I tried to journal. I would do a little journal for like, you know, a few months before I fall off the wagon. And I found as I got more into writing that writing is like kind of substitute for a journaling in a sense. It's not the same thing. I'm not really writing all my personal thoughts to it. But a lot of the things that I'm thinking about or mulling over kind of gets worked into fictional stories in like in a weird way sometimes. And I don't know, just, I don't know, it's interesting in that sense. Like, using fiction to kind of work through the things I'm thinking about, and but not writing it down in the journal, which probably might be just as helpful, but I guess it's easier. Sometimes I'm writing fictional stories, it's easier that way.
Well, Nicole, I read some of your writing advice that actually, I've never been able, brave enough to really do this as you did it. And Brooke and I have been, you know, we talked about this earlier in the show. And you wrote, basically, never be afraid to start over. You'll get much further ahead than trying to patch up something you know that's not working. And you said that you actually threw out 30,000 words. I believe it was last November. And so I'm interested in this. How throwing out things plays into creativity. So I was wondering if you could tell me more about how you gave yourself permission to throw away words and start over, and perhaps how the words you threw out, you know, maybe influenced your new start.
Well, I guess I find when I'm revised, I always throw out words. Like, I guess I see the writing process as, like, I'm always, like, iterating in a sense. So I'm like, even my first things, the first batch of words I write is just my first thoughts of the ideas, like a living form of brainstorming, but more fleshed out in a sense. And that it's just for me to figure out what works, what doesn't work. And when it doesn't work, I can really feel it, and it's easier to throw it out than kind of just tinkering with it. Cause I found I waste a lot of time trying to make something work that doesn't. I think I did it the other day. I was spent, like, you know, a good day and a half trying to make this scene work. And I realized it's not working. It's easier to throw it out and move on. And when I say throw it out, I mean I stick it in another Word document that I will go back and cannibalize later on, which have, a lot of my stories have gotten that way. Even, I think in the Conductor that came out, I had a couple of scenes that had gotten taken out and I actually retooled them later on, or it came from actually different parts of writing that I retooled and stuff. And actually, for my second book, there was a couple of scenes that were originally in the first book that I took out and retooled it for this one, and it works much better and almost like I planned it. I mean, every revision I do, I take out tons of words. I think for the second book, I took out 40,000 or so. In the end, I guess I do replace a lot of that words back in there. But just for me, some of those words I take out are just my first thoughts of stuff. Because I do a lot of my writing is actually that's not actually writing itself. It's me, like, staring at a wall, mulling over different ideas before I write, commit them to words, basically. And I do a lot of, like, it's imagining how it works in the scene and try different angles. Sometimes I pre-play a scene, like, maybe 10 different ways before I actually commit it to writing, because I want to think of all different angles for certain things like that. So I guess it's just me just thinking of just trying different things and before I commit to something finally. And I'm always really open to trying new things, so it's easy for me to throw stuff out and try something different until it works.
I think that's pretty incredible, Nicole, actually. I mean, we've talked to so many writers over these years on this podcast, and that's one of the first times I've heard a process like that. And also just, like, that you must be really prolific. So thank you for sharing that with us. And also, I mean, maybe segues nicely into this next question, because I hear that this is going to be a series. You have The Undertakers coming out in November. So did it start as a series? You know, maybe it has to do with all this extra content that you're cannibalizing. I love this idea of endorsing, cannibalizing your own writing. So did it start as a series, or did it morph into one?
I only had the Conductors when I initially went out on submission, and the publisher came back saying, how about two books? And at first I'm like, I only wrote this one book, so I put everything in this one book. And I was like, where do I go for a second book? And I start revising, like, I kept pulled stuff out, and I was like, oh, I have lots of stuff for a second book. I think I can handle the second book. So I actually was initially panicking about doing a second book. It wasn't, like, part of my plan. And I was like, you know, I just realized I had a bunch of stuff I could write about. And that's with me. I always have a bunch of ideas. I have a bunch of ideas in general for this series. I do a sliver, because The Conductor takes place about 10 days or so. So it's a sliver of time for the characters and the design around mysteries. And I see them as always having adventures before and after this book itself. So it's really easy. And that's the beauty of, like, writing mysteries, that there's always, like, more mysteries out there you can write about. And it's easy to kind of imagine them. You just have to figure out, you know, who done it, who's the murderer, and all that other stuff.
Well, Nicole, our first question had to do with your writing journey. And now that you've come this far and you're at a, you know, kind of crucial, critical milestone of publishing your first novel, what advice would you give to our listeners about writing?
best advice. I guess for me, it's always have something to write down, like a notebook or your phone or something like that. Something at hand to write, jot down ideas. Because I always find I always get ideas randomly, like, you know, all the place. So it's nice to write have something on the hand to write things down. For me, like, I always carry a bunch of notebooks in my purse, in my bag and stuff down the hand. And other advice, just general, of be kind to yourself. Allow yourself to take breaks. Allow yourself to have days that where you don't write anything at all. Try not to force yourself to write X amount of words or get too focused on what everyone else is doing, because everyone else has different methods. Everyone else has different things going on in their lives, and comparing yourself to someone else is not great for you. And also, don't take everyone's advice out in the world, because lots of advice out there doesn't fit everybody. And just basically pick and choose what works for you. And there's also trial and error. Don't be afraid to try different things. If it doesn't work out, drop it and try something new.
I love that. I'm going to take all that advice, actually. I think that's really great on every point. So thank you for joining us, Nicole.
Thanks so much, Nicole.
It was great talking with you.
We'll be right back with today's book talk.
For this week's book pick, I'm picking Angie Thomas's new novel, and that's because last year I was honored to be part of a webcast with her, and she wrote The Hate U Give, which was a best-selling novel that was later made into a movie. And if you don't know the story, it's a really important novel about a 16-year-old girl, Star Carter, who finds her voice after witnessing her best friend get killed by a police officer. And Angie just came out with a new novel, Concrete Rose, which is actually a prequel to The Hate U Give. And I thought this was interesting because so often authors focus on sequels, you know, to kind of keep the story going about their main character. But a prequel, especially of a young character like a Star, is in some ways more fascinating because we get more context on the world Star comes from and an interesting tension between knowing where she ends up, but then going backwards to kind of put the pieces together. And so Concrete Rose is about Star's father, Maverick Carter, who is at a crossroads in his life. He's 17 years old, and he's a member of a gang, and he's just discovered he's the father of a three-month-old son. So the novel is about how Maverick navigates this nettlesome path of masculinity, and what's interesting about it to me is how he's able to survive and bloom, not because of his own, you know, willpower necessarily, like so many of these stories kind of focus on that kind of, I don't know, inner independence, but because of the love and support around him. You know, his family and his mother in particular play a big role. But the most riveting moments come with his neighbor, Mr. Wyatt, who mentors Maverick and gives him a job. And it's interesting to see how that mentorship is later reflected in the Maverick we know as an adult, and then in Star in The Hate U Give. So it's interesting to see a novel expand into a multi-generational saga of sorts. And I hope Angie keeps developing this story, you know, into the present and the past. I think it'd be really cool to have several novels about her and her family.
Cool, Grant. Thanks for that. That is quite the sell and makes me want to read it. And we hope it makes you want to read it too. And just like Angie developing into the present and past, you can also delve into the present, past, and future of this podcast because it's weekly. We have so many archives that you can go back and check out. If you're a new listener, we hope you will. We've interviewed some amazing people over the last 2.5 years. And as I said, we're weekly. We hope that you'll check us out and put us in your feed and share us with a friend, and we'll see you next week.